useful to remind ourselves, what are we talking about when we start up again, especially after a long weekend. So let me tell you what I think we're talking about, and you can correct me if you think we're talking about something other else. We're talking about Fourier integral techniques, and I introduced the concept of a pseudo-differential operator, and I proved certain things about them. So let's see how we recap this at rapid pace. I have a function u of x with reasonable properties, such as Schwarz class, but I might dualize it, so it might be a tempered distribution, and I can write it as the inverse Fourier transform of the Fourier transform, e to the I c x minus y u of y dy dx. That's an identity for such functions. And if I differentiate, so I'm going to set d, that's a vector, so dj is now one component, is 1 upon I partial by partial x, j. Then if I operate by d to the alpha here, it operates by c to the alpha here. And if I multiply by functions, so let's suppose I have a of x, if I multiply by functions here that are not too outrageous, no, I guess it doesn't matter at all. I can multiply by functions here, but it's a function of x, and these are y and c, so I can always multiply by a function of x. And so inside the integral, I've now put in a function of c and x, a polynomial in c and a function of x. And pseudo-differential operators are, of course, a generalization of this. So let a of x c be a symbol, then we define an operator, a of x d, operating on u of x, by this formula, or the analog of this formula. This is a dot because these are vectors. A of x c u y dy dx. Interesting formula. And then what does it mean to be a symbol? Well, let's put it in a box. A symbol. So let me say it rather this way. The symbol class. Symbols, and they have an order, and they have a row and a delta. And I guess I'm just considering everything over R, N. And, it consists of these functions. A of x, c, which I want to be smooth. In certain cases, certain technical cases, it's important to take, especially if you do nonlinear problems, it's important to take symbols with not very much smoothness. Then you have to count a lot. So let's take them infinitely smooth, so at least these that we don't have to count. And we're only going to do linear theory today in any case. And it's C infinity in X, so X is anywhere in Rn. And it's C infinity in C, well, but sometimes the origin is a problem. So it's C infinity in Rn in X, and the Cs are Rn, but I don't want to look at zero because sometimes at zero it's a problem. And I'd like to call this the cotangent bundle of Rn minus zero, minus the zero section. That's a fancy way of saying it. Anyway, all it says is a smooth function, but I need more such that a of x c behaves well under differentiation. And we already saw that when we looked at pseudo-local property of pseudo-differential operators, and we're going to see it under composition. So I need this to be bounded by m powers of c. So one way to say that is take absolute values of this, and it's bounded by c to the m. But I also have to take lots of derivatives. So I need to take dx c to the beta, dx to the alpha, and also have it bounded by m, but with changing powers. So this constant can depend on alpha and beta. And I want things to improve when I take beta derivatives by a factor of rho each time, and possibly get worse when I take x derivatives by a factor delta. And there's traditional ways these are put in. I guess rho is the gain and delta is the loss. And always. In all cases, you can consider any symbol class you want, but by calculus, you expect 0 less than or equal to rho and delta less than or equal to 1, and typically, that is, things behave well when 0 is less than or equal to delta is strictly less, the gain is strictly less than rho, less than or equal to 1. And while I'm doing this, there's a funny story. If you look at either scattering theory or you look at the microlocal smoothness of the Schrodinger equation or other dispersive equations, where bicharacteristics go to infinity rapidly, you end up in the following situation. Rho equals 0 and delta equals 1. Not so great. Funny situation. But in any case, these do come up, but that's where we're talking about this is good and this is bad. And bad do come up sometimes. But we'll only talk about good symbols. And then let's see. What did we decide? We decided that anything of this form, you take a symbol, AXD, you take a symbol and you make an operator out of it, and it took Schwartz class to Schwartz class. And by duality, it then took tempered distributions to tempered distributions. And it also behaved well on the distributions of compact support, although I have to talk, I'm going to leave that for a second because I have to talk about what's properly supported. But I want to say a theorem that we proved, which was I think the last theorem of last week, and I'll get my numbering system right if somebody tells me what number that was, because I didn't manage to note it I was counting from the beginning and I skipped a few from my notes, so I didn't actually. Anyone remember what number that was? 5.7? Thanks. 5.8. Okay. And it was the following. I think if that theorem is the same as this, I hope it is. That is, if A of XC is in S M rho delta with I needed rho greater than 0 and I need delta less than 1, then you can look at distributions and you find the following thing, that if you apply AXD to U and you look at singular support, it cannot be worse than the singular support of U. 5.6, thanks. But it goes up to 5.8 in case I want to number new things. 5.7, if it wants to number new things. Okay, and that's the pseudo-local property. Okay, let's see. What I want to do is I want to talk about composition of operators. So this is interesting, and it's just a general fact. What I'd like to do is start composing operators, composition of operators. So let's see, something I want to do is, I'm interested in expressions. I'm interested in A, X, C in a symbol class, say, M1 rho delta, and B, X, C in a symbol class, say, M2 rho delta. M needn't be positive, of course. It can be positive or negative. We're interested in what happens if we do this. What does that do to you? We're interested in this expression. So, first off, we should think it should have something to do with the product of symbols. So I'd like to state a lemma, which I guess is 5.8, which says something, at least if I multiply symbols. So my statement is this will have something to do with the following thing, AXC times BXC. Something to do with it. Something to do with this. And I want to explain what this something is. So we have to multiply symbols. So let's say that in that situation. So if we're in that situation, A is in my SM1 rho delta, B is in SM2 rho delta, then AB, that's a function of XC, is in SM1 plus M2 rho delta. It's just a fact of life. Now, there's a more general statement that I might ask about, which is, what happens is if A is in SM1 rho 1 delta 1, and B is in SM2 rho 2 delta 2, what is the product? Well, you have to take, then AB, you add the powers, it's kind of obvious, but you have to take the worst case for rho 1, rho 2. So rho 1 is an improvement, so you have to take the minimum of poor rho 1, rho 2, and hope that's not too bad. And then delta 1 and delta 2 are bad things, which lose, so you have to take the maximum. But in any case, they're estimates, so why don't you, when you know you have to consider A and B, just take the worst case in either one and go from there. Okay, and now I want to talk about what happens when you compose. Well, if I compose, composition is a multiplication of operators, right? A matrix, you matrix multiply. So operators, you're multiplying operators. So if you just multiply functions, you just multiply. So the multiplication of functions is just multiply them. One idea is if you have A of X, C, and you want to find its inverse, why isn't it 1 over A of X, C? Why isn't it that? Well, if A doesn't vanish, that will work for functions. But for operators, it's almost right. That's the story. So let's move on and learn about how to. Well, so that says, I mean, I just take A of XC times 1 up over A of XC, and of course I get 1, unless it's singular when I'm not sure what I get. But multiplying operators is not so handsome. So let's multiply operators. Or what do you say? Compose operators. Compose operators. So let's compose B. Let's make B, and then after that do A. So if I start with B, I'm going to take a function U. So I want to take B X D U, and afterwards I want to have A X D. Right? And this is a function of X. Misleading notation. So what do I do? Well, I take U, and I want U to be a function of Y, and I take its Fourier transform. and then I multiply by the symbol, which I'm going to give variable z and eta, e to the I eta z minus y. That's b, a modulo factor of 2 pi. 2 pi, I'm going to do it twice, so I guess I get it 4n, 2n. And then now this is a function of z, so what do I do with it? And then I do d eta. Now what do I do with this function of z? I take its Fourier transform, so dz, and then I multiply it by a symbol, so a of cx, e to the I x minus z c double integral. Did I forget anything? Dy, d eta, dz, dc. And my question is this a pseudo-differential operator? And the answer is no. There are too many integrals. The pseudo-differential operator has one Fourier transform, one inverse, and this has two of them. So our theorem is a composition of two pseudo-differential operators is not a pseudo-differential operator. But of course, that's against all one's been taught. So what I have to say is the pseudo-differential operator is not an exact quantity, but an asymptotic quantity. And the composition of pseudo-differential operators is, in fact, asymptotic to, has an asymptotic series in pseudo-differential operators. And that's what I want to develop. So that's what I want to explain to you. So here's a theorem on composition. So this is theorem. So I want to explain this line to you, and I'm going to do that in a little while. In a few moments, but let me at least state the theorem first. So this is theorem 5.9, and it goes as follows. Same hypotheses. So we have to let A be a symbol. A X C is going to be an S. M1 rho delta, let's fix rho delta. BXC is going to be another symbol, so that's M2 rho delta. And I'm going to need this for composition with 0 less than or equal to rho, strictly less than delta, sorry, delta strictly less than rho, less than or equal to 1. Rho is allowed to be 1. 1 is the classical good case. Delta equals 0 is the classical good case. And it will be our hypothesis from now on that this relation holds. Otherwise, we can't make too much progress except in special situations. Then the operator. So this is an operator. It's just not pseudo-differential. Then the operator. A of xd applied to b of xd is described by an asymptotic expansion in pseudo-differential operators. And I'll give you that expansion. So it's actually the AB of XC. So to give you a pseudo-differential operator, I have to give you a symbol. And that symbol is the following thing. Well, it's asymptotic to sum J greater than or equal to 0 of minus I, let me do the following. Sum over alpha greater than or equal to 0, alpha the multi-index, I minus I to the absolute value of alpha, the length of alpha, over alpha factorial. We know how to take factorials of multi-indices times partial c to the alpha a of x c times partial x to the beta b of x c. Alpha b of x c. And I'm going to tell you the precise meaning of what it means to be an asymptotic expansion when I give you the proof, because right now it'll be a little dry, and the proof will tell us what it means. Okay? And then... But before I go on, I'd like to say a little bit more. So let's have a definition. I guess I already had the definition of the principal symbol. So the principal symbol. Well, all I've demanded to be in a symbol class is an inequality. An inequality. And so it's not clear how the functions A behave precisely. But what I want to do is consider the symbols decomposed in homogeneous powers. And so so I want the part of the term of A, which is the highest power homogeneity, to be the principal symbol. So let's see. That says A of X C. How do I want to say this? I'm a little stuck because they can be mixed powers right now, and I have to think what I want to exactly say. Yes, everything is the highest power in psi, that's what I mean. X is a C infinity variable and is the highest power in psi. So I guess what I want to say is that let's assume for our calculation of a principal symbol, let's assume that A and B are homogeneous. So A of X lambda C is equal to lambda to the M1 A of X C. And if not, if there are other parts of A which behave lower homogeneous terms, let's only consider the top part of A. So let's only consider the part of A which obeys this. And similarly, B of X lambda C is going to be lambda to the M2 B of X C. So that's the top. So these are the top. So, and then that says that these are homogeneous symbols, and they're their own principal symbols. So these are homogeneous. But now let's look at one of these terms. How does one of these terms behave? So the terms above, well, there's some combinatorial factor times D by D C to the alpha A of X C, D by DX to the beta B of XC, and then there's a sum over alpha. I'm going to take alpha equal to some, I need a letter, J. So I'm going to say take all derivatives of order J, not bigger, not less, but order J. And C occur here and C occur here. And what I want to say is that this is, in fact, by inspection, A is homogeneous degree M1, B of M2. So this is going to be homogeneous degree of M1 plus M2. By our lemma, it will have rows and deltas as before, just because that's a symbol. But I've now differentiated alpha many times with respect to C and alpha many times with respect to X. So I have a minus alpha here times rho, so my decay, my growth homogeneity lessens, or my decay increases, rho times the number of derivatives I've taken with respect to C, but there's a loss with respect to delta. And because we've taken rho greater than delta, this goes to zero. Minus alpha to the rho, the degree, M1 plus M2, it's finite, minus alpha, rho minus delta, goes to minus infinity as alpha gets large. It's alpha. Beta is alpha. I'm trying to copy down that line, and I've now made a mistake twice. Okay, and now I want to do one more. So let's count. These are top homogeneous terms, so they're their own principal symbols. Own principal symbols. But when I compose them, they're terms of different homogeneity. So what is the principal symbol? So the principal symbol of A of XD, B of XD, is simply when J is equal to 0. So it's the product of the two terms, A of XC, B of XC. So it's incredibly easy. If I had that hesitation and then I made these homogeneous, but if each A and B were a sequence of decreasing homogeneous powers with top term M1 and top term M2, then I would take the top term times the top term, and that would be the top term of the product, and that would be the new principal symbol. Good. Question before I go on to prove Theorem 5.9 is, what happens if I take a commutator of operators? So let's try it. So how about a commutators? Because those play a role. What happens if we did BA? So let's try it. So AB of XD minus BA of XD. Well, X and D don't commute. So it's probably not going to be zero. But let's write it in terms of its asymptotic expansion. So this and this. Well, it's equal to operator, so, and let's write it, simply write its symbol. Its symbol. Right? Let's just study its symbol. Well, this symbol is that, so it's going to be A of X, C, B of X, C, plus higher order terms, plus a sum, alpha, greater than or equal to 1. And this one is B of X, C, A of X, C, minus a sum, alpha, greater than or equal to 1. And the top terms cancel. So a commutator cancels the top order terms. And we have to now calculate what's next. So let's do it in the following way. Let's calculate what's equal to 1, because that becomes more important, plus greater than 1. So what's equal to 1, let's just copy this down. It's minus 1, it's minus I to the 1 over alpha factorial times the first term is dc alpha a xc dx alpha b of xc, and the second one is dc alpha, but a is now b. B, X, C, and I'm going to write it in a slightly funny order. D, C, alpha, B of X, C, D, X, alpha, A of X, C. I just wrote down what are the first order terms, and then this is also greater than or equal to 2 of whatever's up there. And I want to point out that this is... the first term is equal to 0, so the principal term in a commutator is equal to, sorry, not the principal term in a commutator, because the principal term is now down 1 by our definition, but there's a cancellation at the highest level you might expect, and there's another, and this becomes the principal term, and that's an interesting quantity, and it's otherwise known as the Poisson bracket, so it's a 1 upon I, alpha factorial in all cases actually is 1, the Poisson bracket of A and B as a function of X and C. So this is an interesting thing, which says that we have symbols which are just functions on cotangent space, and their products correspond to operators, and the operator products are not so clean because they have that asymptotic expansion, but they have some nice properties, including that they commute to highest order, and the next highest order involves a Poisson bracket of functions on the cotangent level. And so, in some sense, there's a connection with mechanics, because the Poisson bracket is best known as mechanics. So this is, you might say, our first connection with Hamiltonian mechanics. Sorry? Alpha is equal to 1. These are first order, these are all one derivatives, but alpha has, you know, alpha's d by dx1, d by dx2, d by dx3, those are all first order derivatives. So these are all the, I could have sum over d, okay, for Dmitri I'll do that too. I'm going to write what alpha is. This is 1, this is minus I, this is j equals 1 to n, d by dxj, d by dxj, d by dxj, minus d by dxj, d by dxcj. I've now just made explicit what the alpha multi-indices of length 1 are. And that's indeed the Poisson bracket. So, connection with Hamiltonian mechanics. Good, I like that. I have to prove that theorem. So, let's just get to work. So I want to apply AXD, BXD to U. And I'll take U in C infinity or Schwarz class. Let's take U in Schwarz class. And we have this long formula up there. But I can't reach it anymore, so I'm going to copy it down here. So, AXD, BXD, and that way you can check me again. U of X is equal to a lot of derivatives, a lot of integrals, 2 pi to the 2n, double integral. On the outside, I have e to the I, c, x minus z, the symbol AXC. But I don't apply that to, and I apply that to a double integral of e to the I eta, z minus y, b of z eta, and then I apply this to u of y, d eta does the first operator, dz dxc does the second operator. And now I want to do something, this is really nasty, to use an eraser. For people who take notes, it's really nasty for a lecturer to use an eraser to erase a few details and then write a long formula again with a few brush strokes. But I'm going to do it. So I want to actually write this as y. So I've now made an error. And the error is, I have a xy now, where I used to have a xz. So I have to change this to make it good again. So let me move this over, and it's e to the I, and if I put in here c minus eta, I think that does the trick. I seem to have an extra C. Ah, I did something wrong. Let me see. I have a xz, so now I have a xz here. Good. Then I have a xy, which I didn't have, minus xy, so I need a plus xy. Good. It's a true identity. Okay? And now I want to do the following thing. I want to take A, and I want to Taylor expand in C. So what's the Taylor expansion of A in C? So let me leave a little room for that, and I'll put it in the middle of things, 2n, double integral. C minus A, I think the signs are right. Let me check. It could be wrong. I put in a minus CY. So, oops, so I need a not minus. Yeah, so I need another minus. So it's eta minus C. Thank you. Eta minus C, because it was an eta Z minus Y. Now it's eta minus C Z minus Y. Perfect. Thanks. And then, let's see. So let me put this down a little bit. E the I C X minus Y. Now I want to Taylor expand A, and I want to Taylor expand A around the eta. So instead of writing A down, I'm going to write a Taylor series for A. So it's going to be J equals 1 to some finite quantity, J, capital J. J has now become a multi-end index. I guess that's all right. 1 upon J factorial, partial C to the J A, of X eta times C minus eta to the J's power. And then I have, and I'm going to fill this in a sec, but I've stopped my Taylor, it's a finite Taylor expansion. Otherwise, I'm not sure what it means in this. So I have to put the Taylor remainder in, which is the Taylor remainder at level J plus 1 of that function A. Okay? And then we carry on that double integral. Now, I'm going to put all the integrals in front. So this now gets applied to, well, this is now multiplying e to the I, eta minus c, z minus y, b, z eta, u y, dy, d eta, dz, dc. And this also is e to the I, eta minus c, z minus y, b, z eta, u y, dy, d eta, dz, dc. And then I'm going to be nasty again with my erasing trick, which is we notice that c minus eta to the j power times e to the I c minus eta z minus y can be rewritten as a number of z derivatives of this exponential. So it's 1 upon I d by d z to the j power. Let's get the sign right. It was a c minus eta, so it's a minus. So if I take a z derivative, I get a power of I eta minus c, and I get a so I need a 1 minus 1 over I to cancel it. And this we leave alone. And now one more thing is, where are the z's? They're in the exponent, they're in here, they're nowhere else. So I can rewrite that first term as 1 upon 2 pi to the 2n plus a Taylor remainder term, which I'm not going to treat right now, e to the I c x minus y, sum j equals 1 to capital J, 1 upon J factorial dc J to the A, x at eta, then e to the I, eta minus c, z minus y, and I'm integrating this by parts, this turns into a plus sign, so I get 1 upon I, d by dz, to the J power on B, z eta, all on u y, dy, d eta, dz, dc. And this is a sum up to some finite J, capital J. It's because I had a c minus eta here, and I replace it by this identity. C minus eta to the j is this derivative differential operator on the exponential. So it only acts on the it's a derivative on the exponential. I've used that identity before in front of you. J actually is supposed to be from 0 to capital J. J is a multi-index, so I guess I'm saying this wrong. I need J greater than or equal to 0. Sorry? And J capital is your choice. So I don't have to answer that. You tell me. It's an arbitrary finite Taylor extension. It's an equality because the next line is the Taylor remainder. If I stop here at J, I put everything else in the J plus 1 Taylor remainder. TR is Taylor remainder, which has its own charm. Okay? Then I move along. And now let's observe something about the Z integral. That if I do perform the Z integral, here's a Z, and here's a Z. And so if I perform a Z integral, I'm actually simply taking the Fourier transform of this function of Z and evaluating at a point. So there's this involves the following thing. Here's a function of Z, partial Z to the J, dz, eta, and now I take this Fourier transform with respect to Z, and that's a function of zeta, say. And if I do the Z integral, that evaluates this function of zeta at zeta equals eta minus xi. And then let's look for the xi integrals, the xi's on the ground. And there's no xi's, no xi, no xi, and no xi. So that's the integer. And here I have a xi and a xi. So that's the inverse Fourier transform, looking at every z and replacing it with x. Sorry? You focus on the z integral, forget all the rest, and integrate by parts. And then I inverse Fourier transform, and it sets all, and it uses up two factors of root 2 pi, so I have a 2 pi to the n left, and it uses up two integrals, so I have two left, e to the I of I have e to the I eta x minus y. Let me write what I have in mind down. J is equal to 1 to capital J, partial c to the jth power, a of x, eta, then 1 upon I to the J, partial z to the J. Well, a z derivative is an x derivative, b of x, eta. Sorry, this is in the way. U of y, dy, d eta, plus Taylor remainder. And if I take the summation outside, I can write this as a sum. J is equal to, it's supposed to start at 0. J, 0 up to capital J, 1 upon I to the jth power, that's this summation, and that's this, of a quantity which we observe to be partial CJA of X, partial XJB of X, well, we observe what I want to say. This is a pseudo-differential operator whose symbol, so I'm going to indicate you the symbol, is A of X, C, B of X, C. Of course, I've written C for eta. And that's almost the proof. And the proof finishes by studying the Taylor remainder. And so what I'm not going to do, I'm going to neglect today, is you finish by showing that the Taylor remainder which depends on J plus 1 smooths the function U to something related to order J, is smoothing of order increasing with J. And so that allows us to say, what do we mean by asymptotic expansion? So I'm going to say this completes the proof, at least as far as I'm going to do today. So that allows me to explain what it means to be an asymptotic expansion. Yes? It takes a function and outputs a function which is smoother. And if you ask, and it's a smoothing which goes to infinity with J, which means if you demand that the output function has 33 derivatives, I can choose J high enough so that will be true. And if you need 330, J has to be a bit higher. Well, but still in a C infinity function, there's a sense of how many derivatives an operator takes. So this is an operator which takes derivatives. You can measure, yes, you can measure it in terms of the seminorms of C infinity. So if you need to measure, you can measure the result in seminorms where you need 33 less derivatives than you started with. So now we have a sense of what it means to be an asymptotic expansion. It means that I can write this quantity down to arbitrary extra smoothing order with arbitrarily extra smooth error. And so this is what the science of pseudo-differential operators does. It solves problems, not completely, but it solves problems up to smooth error. And so you can talk not maybe about exactly the solution, but you can, at least not in the general case, but you can talk about the singularities in the solution, because those are what you control. Okay? So, good. I want to now talk about elliptic operators. So let's see, that's a definition. Five point ten, which says AXD is an elliptic operator. If, well, one AXC is in a symbol class of some M rho delta, and I'm going to use my demands are going to be that delta is smaller than rho, so I can do these composition things. And non-vanishing. And so let me quantify non-vanishing. So what I want to say is the following thing, that AXC, well, it's an operator of order M. So it doesn't grow more than C times C to the M. But I also want a bound from below. So I want that to be, maybe I'll make this a C1. I want there to be a C0 C to the M as well. And I guess this is a demand for all X in Rn. But we could localize. I meaning I can consider a compact set of x at a time if I want. But for us, most expedient is to just have it everywhere. If you don't like that, have it your compact set, and then extend it by just a standard power outside, and then you can ignore that place because it's pseudo-local. I'm only interested in that compact set. This is an elliptic.
Yeah.
For a hyperbolic, I have to worry about where the principal symbol vanishes. Here, I have to worry about where the symbol vanishes. And you're right, that's a sensitive point. I could also ask, maybe I'll put that in, because that's a good point, for all C greater than some R. So the principal symbol is going to dominate for large C. So I'll only ask that for large C, and for small C, I don't care. We could do that. I wasn't going to, but thanks for reminding me. I will now. So this is now a question about the principal symbol of A. Yeah. Doesn't matter. So let's see, I have a theorem. So this is theorem 511. Which is, if A XD is elliptic, and I guess I want A, let's say AXC, let me be precise, AXC is M rho delta, with those stipulations in rho and delta. Then there is an operator. Well, let's give it by a symbol. So A symbol, Q XC, which is going to be a symbol in a minus M rho delta. So if M is negative, minus M is positive. M is positive, minus M is negative. Such that when I make the operators PXD, I apply to QXD, it's the identity. I can invert these. And what I'm going to do is actually do the following thing. It's going to be the identity plus an operator made out of S minus infinity. I don't know how to make a notation. Something that takes any distribution gives me a C infinity result. A. Yes. Thanks. I called this P in my notes, so I'm going to now call it P. So I don't get confused again. And not only that, this Q is going to have the property that it also works in on the other side. It's a left and right inverse modulo S minus infinity. So this also is an operator of that's infinitely smoothing. Sorry? This is more like an elliptic equation. So we're not really propagating anywhere. That's more like a hyperbolic equation. This is more like I can invert Laplace's equation up to singularities, up to smooth errors. There are even methods, but I'm not going to go into that for want of time, of in the elliptic case, getting rid of those errors, partly because this is a very compact operator. And so identity plus compact, you know a lot about its inverses, like it's Fred Holm and that sort of thing. Okay. Yes? Final version of a definition? Let's include for all psi bigger than R. There is this an R such that A behaves like this for C bigger than R.
You want A0 greater than
C. Sorry?
C0 greater than C. C0 is positive.
Ah, yeah, we better do that. C0 is not equal to 0. And it better not be. Yeah. Right. You know what I'm going to do with those zeros? Cut it off smoothly, put it here. It only counts what happens outside the ball if you're considering only smoothness. Okay. Before I prove the theorem, let's draw some corollaries, and then we can have a break. So it's an immediate corollary, which is really elliptic regularity in this setting, which is as follows. I mean, again, we need this condition on delta and rho, and let's set if P elliptic, so PXD elliptic, then for any distribution U, the singular support of U is equal to the singular support of P of X D U. Well, let me explain. I'm thinking that I want to solve an equation P X D U is equal to F. So the singular support of P X D U is the singular support of F. And U can't, unless F is singular at a point, U cannot be singular at that point. That's what this says. And it says further that you identify exactly the singular support of U with the singular support of P of U. Well, part of this we already know, because we know that the singular support of a pseudo-differential operator cannot be bigger than the singular support of U. So we know that singular support of PU has to be in singular support of U. So what we have to do to show this is the other way around. So P can't increase the support, but what you show is P also can't decrease it either. And so let's prove this corollary, because these are short and sweet. So what the theorem says that I can write U, well, what the theorem says that PQ is equal to the identity, or QP is equal to the identity, plus a smooth operator. So that says I can write U, which is the identity on U, is equal to QPXDU plus V, and with V, C infinity. So V is not in the question. It's only what happens. But of course, I can write this as Q of P of U plus C infinity. And so, since U is equal to, so this is not going to add to the singularities in U, and Q cannot create, and Q is a pseudo differential operator, so it's pseudo local, so it cannot create singularities. So that says U plus something C infinity, which does not disturb the singularities, is Q of P of U. So this cannot have a singularity unless it's in the singular support of P of U, because, so, right? Everyone sees it before, you know, I'm tongue-tied. I have to say it again. Q is pseudo-local. So this result has no more singularities than this result. So this has no more singularities than this result. That says the singular support of U plus this, which is the singular support of U, is the in the singular support of P of U. But that's that lower inclusion that I just wrote down. So we've just proved this. So the corollary is done. Makes us think about other cases. And I guess I should really talk about the wavefront set before I talk about these, but just as a preamble, I'll say that what happens if P is not elliptic? Suppose that you have a wave equation where there's the symbol actually vanishes. Well, then the singular support of U will turn out to be, so then you're going to have a situation where P of U, it will be equal to F, and the singular support, we're interested in the singular support of the solution, and it will be contained in, well, the singular support of F as above, but union the set where P of X, C equals 0. The X such that there is a C where P of X, C equals 0. So this is almost to the point of doing a theorem on propagation of singularities, although not quite. Sorry? So it may vanish for a hyperbolic case. Okay, so let's just do that, and then we'll have a break, which is, let's check examples. Laplacian is equal to, has a symbol, C1 squared plus C2 squared plus Cn squared. Actually, minus Laplacian has this symbol. And so that vanish, that doesn't vanish except at zero. So we can even take R, we can take any R positive, and it still works. And now let's check the D'Alembertian. And I want to write that especially as dt is d dx 0 minus dx 1 squared minus dx n squared. So I now just created a c 0. And of course, its symbol is going to be C1 squared plus C2 squared plus Cn squared minus Q0 squared. And so if I draw this in C space, here's C1, here's Cn, all the other Cs are here, except for C0 is here, it vanishes on, you might expect, the light cone. And that's where the singularities will travel. And we can even be more precise than that, of course, but this is the first step. Let's have a small break and come back. And let me see, my program for coming back is a sketch of proof of the theorem. Sketch of proof of the theorem. And then I guess I want to talk about the wavefront set of a distribution. And I'll see just how far I get. I'm condensing about 6 lectures worth of material into these 2 sessions. So I think I'm not going to be able to get it all. But I'd like to at least talk about the not pseudo-locality, but micro-locality. I'd like to talk about micro-local analysis rather than just this is sort of local analysis. Let's stop for a pause, though. Yeah.
I didn't understand the smoothing. Does it mean a behavior at infinity that it decays
in C space, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
That's what I suspected. But
yeah.
I
didn't quantify because it's not necessarily J degree J smoothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's rho minus delta times J plus some dimensional error. But you can make it arbitrarily large.
Okay.
That's
the
idea.
Then it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's obvious, like, if you apply here a hyperbolic Euler equation, it's just square root of this, like, just dt plus c squared, and,
well,
like,
sort of needs a proof.
The speed with which we propagate along the curve.
Well, I mean, because how about all this? What is this doing to it? See, what I wanted, I'll tell you what I wanted, is, remember I said that you can create a, very few people actually gave me a proof.
Okay.
So what I wanted was to show that I can create a bubble whose sides have slope 1 upon p prime of rho 0. So that if I put 0 inside that bubble, then the solution is 0 up to that slope. Then secondly, I put my data in a disk.
Yeah.
I take those bubbles and I slide them up till the edge of the bubble touches the data. Then I know, and the solution is zero, the data is zero outside, then the solution has to be zero as far up as I can push the bubble. So that says the speed of sound can't be as fast.
Okay.
Has to be less fast or equal to that.
And then you have to show that it's...
And then I have to go on the inside and show that I can get solutions going as fast as that. Then I conclude that that's the sound speed.
Hmm.
Very few people did that. Some people just derived the wave equation.
Yeah, it's like, no?
Yeah, so...
Okay.
So I was ready to actually have a proof.
Okay.
Yes?
Should I bug you now or at the end?
Over what?
This is a problem set from a while back, number 11 from last term, but I handed it in.
I don't even remember it.
I handed it in, but I didn't get it back, so I'm... This is I photocopied it before I handed it in. I left it in your mailbox, so
it
I'm
is
not sure
probably the last problem set.
Yes, it is.
I still haven't.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, no problem. and I have some more.
Okay. Hand them in.
Okay.
When you're ready.
For the cover page.
Yep. Yeah. What did I do wrong?
What was that?
The set of x such there exists xc with p of xc equals 0. We have to microlocalize it to be more precise. So for this equation, it's every x.
How can you define on p prime?
It could be just. I think you can do anything here. It's very robust, right?
Yeah.
I could put an s prime if you want, if you prefer s prime.
We need
E prime. Uh-oh, you mean that's wrong? This is too big? D prime is too big?
D prime is too big. S prime is
good. Let me think of this.
According to S prime is good.
It might be. Let me think about that. I have to think about that. Okay, thank you. I got into slight trouble sort of vacillating between two schools of thought on what a pseudo-differential operator should be. Should it be a sequence of homogeneous powers, or should it be a C-infinity function which obeys an estimate? So I took the former, but then I got in trouble defining the principal symbol and had to say top-level homogeneity, and it was slightly vague. So here, in proving this theorem, I'm going to only prove it in the case where I insist that the P be homogeneous of a certain degree. In fact, I've worked that into my statement of ellipticity. So what I want to do is, I'm going to, so this is the proof. I'm going to be in the case where P of XC is equal to P of X lambda C to lambda to the minus M power. So that's going to be an SM degree M rho delta, our usual stipulations on the rho deltas. And elliptic. So that says for all C not equal to zero, now I can do that because it's going to be homogeneous, I want P of X C not be equal to zero. That'll do. The principal part is always homogeneous. I've now insisted that everything, that it only be the principal part. So now the principal symbol is the symbol. So there, in this setting, the principal symbol is P of X C. And just to contrast, I might have a PM of X C plus PM minus 1 of X C plus PM minus J X C plus, where these are in decreasing powers of homogeneity, and then the principal symbol is this. So what I'm doing is I'm saying, let's pretend all of these are zero, just for simplicity. That at least makes it well defined and cleans up the proof a little bit. Okay? So I'm going to assume, these are my assumptions, these are specializing assumptions which makes the theorem I'm only proving a subset of the real power of the theorem. Nonetheless, the theorem still holds. I'm just not presenting the full proof. So assumptions. Assumptions for simplicity, we could say. Okay. And just to make this a little bit more precise, I'll say the following, that back to our old definition, there's a C, a C naught C, which is greater than zero, M less than or equal to P of X C, less than or equal to C1 C, the M. And let's sit in that setting, be in that setting. And this also gets me into trouble for C greater than 1. Because near 0, these are not exactly homogeneous. I'm getting myself in trouble. Now it's true. And then I don't have to have this for C not equal to 0. Sorry, I'm wallowing between two schools of thought. And now let's proceed to construct Q naught. So I think we can do this neighborhood by neighborhood. And I think I'd prefer to do that. So consider let's see what I want to do. I'm going to first cut off C I want to consider C a cutoff of a neighborhood of zero. So I want of c equals 0. So I want the following to hold. I want eta of c equal 1 for c greater than r, say. C greater than 1, but could be r. And r plus 1, say. And eta of c identically 0 for c less than r. So I only am concerned about c's outside of a ball of radius r plus 1. And I wonder what I want to do, and remember that we thought it was a good idea. Remember, on the symbol level, we had p, x, c. And why isn't p, x, d, inverse operator, equal the operator made out of 1 over p, x, c, 1 over p. 1 over p is a function, and then put in that x, d. So on the symbol level, let's try q of x, c. We'll make an operator out of this symbol, which is just 1 over p of x, c. And since this might have problems near 0, let's multiply it by eta of c. And now let's make an operator out of it. So these are just functions. Let's make an operator. Make operator. So that says, and this is going to be a recursive process. So this is going to be my first guess. So let's make operator out of q0. So it's q0 of xd. That's some function. Well, let me try it on. Try applying it to p of xd and see what we get. So we have an asymptotic series for that. So it's j equals, j is a multi-index, so it's j greater than or equal to, so 0 greater than or equal to j, and let me stop at some n, for example, minus I to the jth power over j factorial. C derivatives, j many of them of q0, x c, and then x derivatives of p of x c. And this is going to be an operator, so let's operator on u of x. So these are now operator notation. This is this function times this function made it into an operator. Operating on u plus the Taylor remainder n plus 1 operating on u. And we can do that for any n. Of course, the first term here, to be explicit, is q times p, which is eta. So that is equal to eta of d operating on u, because that's when j is equal to 0, plus it's not an emergency, is it? It's just fooling around. Oh, I see. So plus then sum j greater than or equal to 1 up to n of this expression plus the Taylor remainder. And the first thing I want to do is say that that this is equal to u of x plus 1 minus eta d u plus this j greater than or equal to 1 up to n. And this, of course, has its support within the ball radius r plus 1 in C space, so it's smooth. So this goes into C infinity. So in terms of our error, we've contributed to the S minus infinity part, and we have the identity. So we have a piece, identity, S minus infinity. plus this sequence here, minus I to the j, j factorial, dxc to the j, q naught dx to the j, p made into an operator. And now what's the error term? So that says q naught is pretty good inverse for p. It gives us the identity. It gives us something which we put in the C infinity error. And then there's the next term. So let's make precise what the next term is. And it's, of course, j equals 1. So it's sum minus I to the jth power, j factorial, over j equals 1 of dxc q naught dx out to the j, dx to the a, p made into an operator, xd operating on u. And remember, p is sm rho delta, and so q naught, well, we don't quite know what q naught is, or at least they have not enunciated what q naught is, but it's made out of p. It's 1 over p. So, in particular, if p is homogeneous degree m, q naught is homogeneous degree minus m, just by inverting this. A little bit harder, but I'm going to ask you to do it, is the chain rule. When you take derivatives of p, it corresponds to derivatives of q. It's in a rho delta class, symbol class. So q naught turns out to be s minus m rho delta. And now the next term down, let's count. M times minus m, that's 0. So this is the identity, which is the identity. So m minus m times 0. And then a c derivative gives me minus rho plus delta. So this operator comes from a symbol class s minus rho minus delta, rho delta. And that's a negative number. So in particular, it smooths a little bit. So what I need to do is just define a procedure by which I can pick off terms one by one. So why don't I do the following? Let's see if I can do this elegantly. Let me see. So let me do an immediate recursion. So let me do a recursion. Then say that the following thing. That suppose. See, I started with a q zero, and what I'm going to do is say suppose I have a q. I have a q zero of xc plus a q1 of xc plus a series up to, say, qj of xc, such that this, suppose I'm able to go, so I just did the zero step, now I'm going to do the j step. Suppose each q, so in the following setting, with each ql of xc in, Q0 is minus m, but these improve. So minus L times rho minus delta, rho delta. So these are in, starts out with minus m homogeneity and decreases, gets even more rapidly decaying. Okay, and suppose I do the following thing. Suppose I do the, this is the induction step. Suppose I do the following thing. I make an operator out of it. So a Q naught XD plus Q1 of XD plus QJ of XD, and I apply that to P. And what I'm going to get is, I'm going to get the identity, just as I did here, identity plus something that's C infinity. Oh, let me apply it to U. No. Identity plus S minus infinity. So it's a smoothing operator. Yes? I'm in the middle of an induction, so you have to have a little patience. But what I'm going to do is deduce what we need to find QJ plus 1. Okay? And I'm assuming that if I do it J times, I can get a remainder here, which I'm going to call, which will be a pseudo-differential operator. And it's given by a symbol. This is still the induction step, so it's all hypothetical, right? Suppose I can do this up to the jth error. So the symbol which gives me this R is a rho delta symbol, and it's a minus J plus 1 rho minus delta. So it's slightly better. So it's rho minus delta better than QJ. Try to define a QJ plus 1. So I'm in this setting. I want to define QJ plus 1. A symbol which will give me an operator which will improve this inversion process. Okay? Well, let's nothing to do but apply it. So apply. Suppose we had. We'll apply this. We're going to have Q0 of XD plus Q1 plus QJ plus 1. That's the one I want. Applied to P XD. And I want it to be the identity. And now what are the next most important terms? Well, all the QJs on P result in identity plus R of XD. And my new term is QJ plus 1 applied to P. Right? And then plus S minus infinity, and I'm suffering a little bit from my lack of decision as to choosing homogeneous powers or not. So I have to remedy this a little bit by saying I want this is a residual which is in this symbol class, but I want to take the top term. So in order to do that, I'm going to change my notation. Sorry about the note takers. There's a J plus 1th term, which is the top term here, and then there's a residual. So it's R J plus 2 of XD. And then there's the S minus infinity, where we put all of our infinitely smooth errors. So this is the residual modulo. I have the identity, a residual, and S minus infinity. And I just split this up into the part I'm going to address now and the part I'm going to address later. And I've addressed all the parts before. The part I'm going to address now, I put here. Everything's later. And clearly, this is going to be in the J plus second class. Okay, could be zero, need not be. Tells me how to define, I have to solve this equation. But these are operators. But we have a symbol calculus, so I want to solve that equation to principal order, modulo the remainder. So solve this to principal order. Solve to principal order. Which is to say, I need a Q, so QJ plus 1 XC, times P XC is equal to minus RJ plus 1 XC. And then when I do this operator multiplication, I find QJ plus 1 XD P XD minus r j plus 1, whoops, plus r, that's the right sign, x d, is equal to, well, I have the way of writing compositions of operators. So the first thing it is you take the symbol j plus 1, you multiply it by the symbol p, and then you make an operator out of it. And this still stays the operator that you already have. But then this has errors in that operator composition. So it's sum l greater than or equal to 1, a multi-index, minus I to the L power, 1 upon L factorial, partial C to the L QJ plus 1, X QJ plus 1, a partial X to the L P, I'm on the operator level, so I have to make this into an operator, plus S minus infinity. So if I simply solve this, then I can solve this. That means this cancels this plus this remainder. It tells me to set. So this tells me to do what? So it tells me how to define qj plus 1 equal to 1 over pxc times minus 1 over pxc times rj plus 1 xc times eta xc. And it's the same procedure we did in the first step. What we'll find is that this will cancel. This operation will cancel this, except for an eta. The eta gets thrown into the S minus infinity part, and it leaves us with all of this, which gets added to the residual. So this process just adds to S minus infinity and R at J plus 2. And that's the procedure. I've now created a sequence of symbols of decreasing order in Q. So it put us in the following situation. Sequence of symbols of decreasing order Q. I've just done the induction step. I assumed I had QJ, and I told you how to define QJ plus 1. Sorry?
Well, I still don't know for the previous Q, which is the previous kind of error.
Suppose I know Q, and I have an R. I can now define a Q plus 1, which gets rid of this R at the cost of a next error. Maybe I should call this error J. J plus 1. This is the J plus 1 error. So I've corrected everything to J. I have a J plus 1 error. Now I correct everything to J plus 1. I have a J plus 2 error. That's the induction step. It has a certain subtlety. But then again, not so subtle. So let me tell you what I've done. We have a Q0 XC plus Q1 xc plus all the way down. What I want to say, asymptotic series for pxd inverse. And so my question is, what does it mean? So I have a lemma, which will help us interpret it. So it's lemma 512, which says that suppose I have a sequence of symbols of decreasing order, and the order goes to minus infinity, then there's an operator with that as Then I have an operator which is asymptotic to that. So let me say this properly. So what I want to do is fix, really, rho and delta. Am I already five? Oh, yes, we had a corollary. Thank you. Fix 0 less than or equal to delta, strictly less than rho, less than or equal to 1. So we don't have to think about it. And suppose, as we just constructed, we're in a situation similar to what we just constructed. We have a sequence of symbols, qj, which are in s rho delta mj. And up here, my mj's are equal to minus m, because that's where q0 sat, minus j times rho minus delta. So decreasing in little steps of j rho minus delta. Could be steps of 1, but they could be smaller steps. But these are arbitrary mj's. So these mj's could be that, but these are arbitrary. So what I need is with mj going down to minus infinity. The statement is, there exists a symbol q, and it's going to be an s rho delta, and the zeroth one is an m0, so it's going to be an m0, such that for all n, this symbol minus the sum j equals 0 to n minus 1, qj, is a symbol in mn rho delta. So what I'm saying is that you find some new C infinity function which is in a symbol class, which behaves like this for finite m. And I'm not claiming that for any particular C this converges. What I'm claiming rather is that if I use Q, it's just as though I were using this infinite series on a particular U. Okay? And for time reasons, I want to make this very brief because I want to jump topics. But here's a proof outline: is you do the following thing for Q. I have to define QXC. It's up to me to define a symbol. Afterwards, make operators out of it. So I'm going to define this to be a sum, j equals 0 to infinity, qj of xc. Well, this trouble is this might be infinity. So I want to multiply this by our cutoff function for 0, 1, or over the ball of radius 1, or the ball of radius r, fixed. And I'm going to define it at not for xc, but for epsilon jxc. And I'm going to take epsilon j going to zero, and I'm going to choose it so that when I take derivatives, I'm going to choose epsilon j going to zero so that for any particular xc, this is only non-zero for finite many terms. And therefore, it converges, only finite series. But if I take C larger, then I'm going to need more of these terms. And that's how I'm going to make Q of C. And so the other thing I need about epsilon C is I need dx to the alpha dc to the beta of these terms, eta epsilon j C qj x C. C. I need this less than alpha, beta, and possibly constants J times C to the MJ rho beta plus delta alpha. And I need this to hold, maybe not all xi, but I need for all xi which are greater than, not 1 over r or something, but maybe 1 over, not bigger than r, but maybe r over epsilon to the j. And if I survive, if I do this, then that sequence for any xi is actually finite, but for larger xi, it corrects itself. And that's a sketch of the proof. I'm going to stop here. So when you have a sequence of symbols decaying to with orders decreasing to minus infinity, you make an operator. You make a symbol which will have that behavior, which is a bona fide C infinity function, and you make your operator out of that, and it will do what you want it to do. Okay. I want to make one more thing about the elliptic case, and that is, I've now constructed, So I haven't quite finished here because I've done a left inverse, right? So I've found Q such that QXD, when I make an operator out of it, PXD is the identity plus K. So I have a left parametrics. And then I have to worry, that works on the left. Well, maybe something different works on the right. So you do a similar construction, and remember I was operating always on the left, and that makes a difference because you take the C derivatives of the operation on the left and the X derivatives of the operation on the right, and not vice versa. This doesn't commute. So, but do the same procedure. You can imagine how it goes. And you find a PXD Q tilde XD, which is the identity plus, say, K2. And maybe call this K1. And both K1 and K2 are infinitely smoothing. And then the question is, what does Q have to do with Q tilde? That was my problem if I did this construction. What does Q have to do with Q tilde? And so this is a standard argument of to get left parametrices. Oh, and I forgot to say, but such a construction is a construction of a parametrics, which is not a solution, but it is a solution up to smooth error. Okay? So, what do I know about these things? Well, how about if I apply this to Q tilde and Q to this and take a difference? So, I need Q P Q tilde is equal to Q tilde plus K1, K1 Q tilde, and then Q on this is Q P Q tilde, which is equal to Q plus Q K2, and whatever Q tilde does, K1 makes it infinitely smooth, and this is infinitely smooth, and Q doesn't change that, and now I take their difference. So I find 0 is equal to Q tilde, that's this, minus Q, that's that, plus K1 Q tilde, which is that, minus Q K2, which is that. So it says that so 0 is definitely infinitely smoothing, and K1, and this is definitely infinitely smoothing, so it says the difference between Q tilde and Q is infinitely smoothing. So if I made this sequence for Q, then I only modify the infinitely smooth part and don't have to disturb any of the terms, the finite terms, in order to have a sequence for Q tilde. So Q and Q tilde, the same series works for Q and Q tilde. So same QJXCs work for Q and Q tilde, QED. So that's a standard construction. So I want to finish by, well, I don't have a time for proofs anymore, but I just want to finish by a couple of statements to jack up the level of charm of these techniques. So statement one, so here I want to introduce the wavefront set. This is, so this is 5.3, I think. So we had a definition. So I want to remind you of a definition, then I'm going to make a new definition. So reminder that a point X naught. So let's consider U a distribution. Maybe sit in the tempered distributions. That's not necessary. I guess U is simply a distribution. This is a reminder. And then we looked at a set X. So we looked at a singular sport of U is a subset of Rn, of the space in which we're on which we're defining our functions. We found that X naught is in the singular support by some construction. And in fact, it's easy to define the singular support by saying when X naught is not in the singular support. So it's not in the singular support of distribution, of this distribution, if there exists a cutoff function, eta of X, C naught infinity, with eta has to have something to do with X naught, so it can't be, so eta of X naught can't be zero. Let's just make it one. Such that eta times my distribution. Now this is also a distribution, right? You take a C naught infinity function times a distribution, it's also a distribution. And I want this to be C naught infinity. That is, if there's a singularity in U, it might be somewhere else, but not in a neighborhood. There's a neighborhood of X naught in which it is not. Okay. And this is an open condition, so the singular support is a closed subset of Rn. And then we had theorems about how pseudo-differential operators are pseudo-local. They do not move the singular support. So that was a reminder. I would like to say this in another way. And actually, I'd like to simply say that this line in another way. it's not equivalent, but it will suffice to study the following. Eta u hat, which is now a function of xi. And it will suffice to simply look at the Fourier transform of this cutoff quantity and decide that this decays rapidly to zero as xi goes to infinity. That's a Schwarz class kind of argument rather than a C naught infinity kind of argument, but it will suffice. You'll know it's smooth if you have that behavior. So now I want to define the, and this is 5.14. And I want to talk not just about points in space and being singular, but I want to talk about points and directions and those being singular. So consider not just X, but X naught, C naught, and that's going to be in, I've been saying the cotangent space of Rn, which means really X is in Rn and xi is in Rn, but I don't want xi to be equal to zero. And really this is a concept which is homogeneous in degree xi, so you could say it's the unit cotangent space or the sphere at infinity in the cotangent fiber. But let's just R to N without zero in R. And I want to make a definition of of when it's to be singular in a direction. So the point, not just x, but x naught, c naught, is in the wavefront set of a distribution, u. So I'm taking this u and putting it over there. And it's easiest, again, to say when it's not in the wavefront set, and then you do by complement. When you define a wavefront set by taking the complement of that concept. If you have the following, if there exists eta in C naught infinity with eta of x naught equal 1, so it's non-zero, so it's not equal to 0. And, well, here I ask that for all C it decayed. But here I'm going to say that it only has to decay near C naught. So that way to say that, and is a, there has to exist an eta cutoff function and a cone, gamma. So a cone is a homogeneous thing in Xi space, gamma in the fiber. So that's R n of Xi with, and it's going to be, I want it to be an open cone, and I want Xi naught to be in the cone, such that I take the cutoff function on my distribution u, I look at its Fourier transform, and I look at that as a function of Xi. I don't want this to be, what does it mean to decay to zero? I want this to be less than or equal to C times Xi to the minus n, Cn minus n for all n. That is, I want it to decay arbitrarily rapidly, but only for Xi in that cone. For all Xi in the cone. And so somehow the picture is as following. Here's Xi space. I don't know how to make X space. Here's X space, but the rest I want to be Xi space. And we choose an X. I'm going to choose X sort of on my Xi coordinate axis, so to speak. And then I say, well, I have to look in Xi space, but I only look at a cone. So this is my gamma. So I'm looking here at X naught, and I'm looking in the cone gamma. And, of course, eta u hat could decay very badly or could grow badly in this direction, but I want it to decay in this direction. So this is Xi naught. That's the vector Xi naught.